Welcome to Cross Arts, the arts discussion program that pulls no punches. When you read, you'll bleed. And if you don't like our critical opinions, too bad, son. We'll wipe your bitchy artsy ass off the floor. This week, I'm pleased to have in my studio Mr. Kevin Jones, writer and director of Jerks 2, which I understand is a fabulous film.
It is indeed, Alex, but I want to, talk about this guy, this alleged film critic who fell asleep at one of my screenings.
What was the guy's name?
Oh, hell, I don't know. I mean, bad segue, what the hell's his name? I mean, this bitch little punk ass comes into my movie and has the temerity to mouth off to me, right? I put this film together with heart and with soul, and I went without snorting a few lines of cocaine this time, man. I mean, times are tough, how those cats are pinching pennies. Shit, you're as much of a suave hipster as I am, and, I write clever dialogue and all, man. So, I know a few things, and that's how it is here out in Jersey.
I do indeed. I think I know the guy. In fact, we've got him on the phone right now.
Oh, yeah?
Mr. Segundo, are you there?
Hello? Look, if it is about the electric bill, we can settle this like grown men. I mean, I can pay $5 now and the rest later.
It's a social call. We're not creditors.
Mr. Segundo, do you know who I am? I mean, do you know what you were doing with all these burned-out journalists in a screening room?
Oh, I don't remember. Was this the evening at the strip club? It was dark there. In fact, I almost went home with a girl with the biggest breast I've seen since 1984. They knew how to make them back in those days, and I...
You don't remember? Well, let me refresh your memory, man. I mean, you get out of your chair, whipped out your bottle of tequila, and you said to the crowd, "Hey man, this film sucks. Let's go to the bar and I'll buy you boys some drinks. Does this tickle your fancy, sir?"
Oh yes, I remember. Such a terrible waste of celluloid, trying to ride the wave of your own desperate fame, playing the same game for a sequel. Well, sir, I've been down that road myself. You have to evolve a one-dimensional character, not stifle it.
No, man, what you did was, rude. And I mean, I don't care what your opinion of the flick was, cowboy, but do I go into your mother's house on a Thanksgiving dinner and say, "Hey, man, this turkey dinner sucks. Let's get plastered at the pub"? No, man, I don't do that shit.
My mother is dead.
Look, I don't care if your mother is dead or not, man. You're rude. You're one of, the most contemptible human beings on the planet. I mean, if you can't respect my film, how can you respect yourself, sir?
Okay, when do we record the opening?
You're on Cross Arts, son. Bend over and take it like a man.
But I have to be somewhere. I have to introduce a two-part podcast with David Mitchell. Well,
there you go again. I mean, thinking of your own self-interests when you should be thinking about me. I mean, sir, I'll ban you from all of my future screenings of my films. Do you know who I am? I'm Kevin Jones, man. The guy behind Jerks, Dog Biscuit, and Jerks 2. I mean, all of these are really quality films made on the cheap with very witty dialogue.
David Mitchell stole my name.
Well, clearly we have a lot to fight about, and that's good. Fighting's good. Anger's good for the soul. But we'll be right back after this word from our sponsor.
Okay, so I am here with the one, the only, David Mitchell, who actually was my first interview for the Bat Segundo show, and who is delightfully agreed. We're actually sort of having lunch, and we're going to sort of do this in two parts, because we don't want Mr. Mitchell, who I called you Mr. Mitchell, but I'll call you David this time.
Please do, otherwise you'll sound like my accountant, and that's exactly a scary proposition.
Yes. So
I can explain, where that £50 went.
We do want him to eat, so we will probably take a short break, and then we'll go to part two, but in the meantime... First of all, David, you have Black Swan Green, which is, you've called this your first novel, but it's your fourth novel, and I think actually there are certain sort of elements that kind of carry over from your previous work. For example, let's go ahead and talk about this. No Cloud Atlas's questions. I know you've talked that to death, so, but I mean, the style of, first of all, I should note that Jason Taylor and David Mitchell have both four syllables,
and the same birthday.
Yeah. They do.
Well, same year of birth. And he mentioned his birthday being in January, I think, as well, which mine is. So, yep.
Oh, gotcha. Well, what part of Jason would be real? What part of it would be imagined?
Importantly, his speech impediment is real.
Yeah.
Or it's drawn from my own life and experience.
To be clear, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yes. What's real?
Yeah, hey, well, actually, this is actually not a novel you've written, but actually a biography of this
no
kid
one
named
realizes.
Jason Taylor. Yeah, exactly.
We do share a lot of mental DNA. My family background was a lot happier than Jason's, but we grew up in the same kind of village in the same time, had a lot of the same concerns. We both wrote deplorably bad poetry, which we nonetheless put through the letterbox of the local vicar who printed it in his parish magazine under a pseudonym. Don't ask, because I won't tell you. And we both, like many bookish kids, probably had skins that were too thin to be helpful at the time, but nonetheless, which is maybe skins which have stood us in good stead in our adult lives. Mm-hmm. If there are any 13-year-olds listening to this, don't worry, it gets better. Just keep reading, and books are your friends, and it's okay, it gets better. Which is a kind of a point. One of the more fanciful reasons for writing the book was to send a phone call to my 13-year-old self to tell him all the things that it would have been very helpful and would have saved a lot of time if someone had told me, informed me, and that's one reason.
Gotcha. Well, I wanted to talk about sort of like the very sort of idiosyncratic sort of style that Jason speaks into. The things like he says me and Moran, and he says, you know, a lot of sort of spaz and a lot of this sort of like, you know, slang. But also there's a lot of like apostrophes and contractions. And I was wondering how it seems to me that if this book was sort of meant to, as a sort of departure from you, there is still this interesting kind of stylistic fixation. So I was wondering, is this kind of an inevitable sort of thing you can't shake? Or?
It's not so much I can't shake, but it's when you're writing in the first person, the voice is absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
If it isn't right, then it's like a skipping CD. It's kind of that dramatic. It destroys the illusion. Mm-hmm. Because you don't believe in the person when the person isn't speaking in an authentic, plausible way. So all the stylistic devices you mentioned were necessary to get his voice right, and it's necessary to get the voice right to preserve the suspension of disbelief.
Now, did this initially start off as a short story? Because I know that there a form of the January Man. Well, you had written one in your early 20s, and also something appeared in Granta.
That's right, yeah.
And I was, I know that the first and the last section of this book are in fact named the January Man. So I was wondering, did this start off initially as a sort of short stories or interconnected stories, or when did it become a novel? How did this come about? Maybe, since we're talking about the voice of Jason Taylor, you might go into how that developed and how the apostrophes and all of the slang and all that sort of. What research did you do, and what did you draw? I'm now asking you.
Oh,
like,
there's
tons of
four
questions.
Yeah, there. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's take it one at a time.
Okay, let's do that. okay. It was a novel. Then it wasn't. Then it was a short story, and then it was a novel again. Okay. By which I mean, I wrote a kind of very early thing in my early 20s on index cards. In a way, my first sort of attempt at a full-length thing. It was rubbish, drivel. But it was necessary drivel as well. I abandoned it after about 4 or 5 chapter stroke months. Mm-hmm. What it had in common was that it was one story per month in the course of a year, a sort of almost like an 18th century poet's shepherd's calendar thing where people would sort of work through the year in that formal pastoral manner. Then I quickly lost interest, no wonder really, and moved on to something else, but I could never quite bring myself to throw away the index cards. I kind of had a sentimental attachment to them, but I moved on to other novels or other manuscripts and eventually got published in other novels, but I still had them. Then in 2003, when Granta magazine included me on its list of under 35 20 and 35 British writers to watch out for. They wanted a bit of homework, I guess, to substantiate their decision. Some writers have things lying around in drawers and whatever, but not me. So I was in the middle of finishing off Cloud Atlas at that point as well, and I didn't want to have to stop to compose a whole new world.
Yeah.
So I just cannibalized the former story, the first chapter of these index cards, yeah, just to knock up a story for Granta, really. But I liked the voice, and kind of felt that instead of looking on my childhood and my youth and the place I grew up as something just indescribably dull, that I wanted to get as far away as possible and kind of go to Mongolia instead, which is kind of how I felt when I was 18. I probably coincided with another sort of shift in my thinking, just towards just being more interested in writing about people, or focusing more on emotions and less on innovation, I suppose. Look at that! Thank you very much.
A sandwich has arrived. But to go to this issue of the 3x5 cards, I understand that you either pilfered this idea from Nabokov, or but I was going to ask. This seems to me a very good way of sort of getting in touch with the '80s using '80s technology, like 3x5 cards.
Yeah, that's right. They're really hard to buy now. You can't find them anywhere. Yeah. It's like trying to buy typewriter ribbon. I've read that. I've always said Nabokov, and I know it's wrong, but I can't stop. Let's say it for the first time. Nabokov.
We both got it wrong.
Yeah,
there we go.
I was told by a Russian speaker that it is Nabokov, and kind of she had 500 years of Russian linguists to back her up, so hey, what do I know? But
it's good to know. I've been wanting to know all these times. I'm saying Nabokov, Nabokov. Okay, good.
But anyway, I couldn't afford a computer in those days, and they were enormous, great things. Anyway, so I wouldn't have had space for one. So that's sort of how I wrote this thing. And I liked the voice. I became more interested in people. Began to realise that there's no such thing as a boring thing. There's no such thing as a boring thing. What a byline. It's just a question of how you look at it. And even a muddy, bleak village in the west of England where people's lives would have been kind of very prescribed compared to the way we live now. Economic recession and it's not dull at all. There's every place and time has the potential to be fascinating. When you look at the people there and when you link it with a bigger picture. At this point, let's have a little interval because the food in front of me is making me salivate. And my voice is getting all slushy.
Yes,
like this
I was waiting for you to conclude this answer so that we could actually go ahead and get the sandwich involved. But if
get the sandwich involved. I love that expression. Yeah. Let's get the sandwich involved. We'll be back.
We'll be back,
dear listeners, shortly after I've finished this club sandwich.
Unfortunately, the sandwich will only be involved with Mr. Mitchell, apparently. David. Okay. So we're back here. This is part two.
That was a really good sandwich, I have to say. You do sandwiches in the States much better than the UK.
Really?
Oh, they're wonderful. Yeah.
Really? What makes the UK sandwich? What do you think that they could do to sort of?
Well, it's about 2 millimeters of the filling in between the slices of bread, whereas here you have the filling that comes wrapped in a kind of a thin skin of bread.
Yeah.
An altogether different animal.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, we were talking about the 3x5 cards in that you used for Black Swan Green, and I was, just as you were starting to salivate over the sandwich, we were kind of talking about the idea that this was some reflection of, like, some possible use of 1980s technology to sort of concentrate upon that.
And
oh, I wanted
that's
to
interesting.
Sort of,
yeah.
Yeah, that's yeah. the angle I was using, although you, yeah. you informed me that it was actually sort of just a cost-efficient thing for you to do, but maybe you can comment upon the whole use of 1980s or, like, paper. I mean, were you using a computer before writing Black Swan Green for other stuff? Or?
Well, I should say that the book I began writing on index cards in the early 80s that eventually, in a very, very roundabout, distant way, turned into Black Swan Green
okay.
wasn't Black Swan Green. It was vaguely autobiographical first novel, the first time around.
Got it.
But use of 80s, well, I guess we can expand that to just a use of 80s-ness. And I chose 1982 because really it was the year of the Falklands War, which is a pivotal moment in post-war British history, I think. And also it's just about the most recent historical period, the most recent period of the past, which is turning into history.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, there's over 20 years now between us and it, and we can kind of look back a little bit now and take the long view. And so I did want to put those kind of end of an era themes or flavors into the book.
I thought so, because I know that we talked about this last time, the whole notion of your fixation with islands and how there's always islands of some variety in your work. And it seemed to me that you put you chose 1982 specifically, oh, I can get an island in this novel.
True. Although, in a way, the village of Black Swan Green itself is also a sort of island.
Mm-hmm.
Surrounded by a sea of loneliness, Ed. A sea of loneliness. But unlike all of my other books, I wanted a book to effectively never leave a very small area of land.
Mm-hmm.
It does once in one chapter in August when Jason goes to a couple of other places in the UK. But apart from that, kind of the book stays on this island of Black Swan Green itself.
Now, I wanted to actually ask you about setting this in 1982, and you have a lot of sort of cultural references, not just, you know, to the Falklands, but also, like, to asteroids and to 82,000. And I'm wondering, your use of cultural references, was this a sort of, were you using more of your memory, or were you using research? And also, why did you kind of avoid, I guess, I mean, you know, there's cliche sort of things, like, you know, the padded shoulders, and, like, you know, the sort of, like, I don't know if you remember this, but, like, you know, where people had, like, the long hair, they'd shave one side, you know, things like that. I'm not sure if you had that in the UK. We had that in the States.
I know. What you have in the States, we get in the UK about 9 months later. Well, it's from a 13-year-old boy's perspective. Well, in a way, the answer to your question is contained in your question, which was the word cliché. And it's a writer's job to avoid them or die, or if you're going to use them, then abuse them or kind of subvert them and find the nuggets of originality that hide in clichés. Mostly from memory, bits from a couple of friends' memories, and a website which in the States is called Friendster, which
really? You actually used Friendster for this?
In the UK, it's called Friends Reunited.
Really?
I did. I lurked. I logged on under a false name because there's usually a very good reason why you haven't been in touch with someone for 20 years. I was finding it quite morbid to kind of wish to short circuit the world's amnesia mechanisms, But there's a place where people can put their memories about school days, and that was quite rich. But on the whole, it was a holiday from research. I didn't have to do much. I read a good history of the Falklands and just one or two memoirs, but other people's things set in the early 80s that I could loot from a little bit. But yeah, not much research was necessary.
What was it about the Friendster sort of stories that kind of felt true to you in terms of, like, you know, as this, I mean, because they're very sort of chatty and sort of gossipy, and they're not always, were you kind of trying to sort of, were you sifting through there to sort of, like, find nostalgia, or what was it that sort of attracted you?
anything that felt early 80s that I couldn't have thought up myself.
Huh.
That's what it was valuable for. Schools were wilder. Things have become more regulated. This is with the teachers, I mean.
Yeah.
Teachers could, what we would now call, physically abuse kids, but what then we'd call just give someone a bit of a slap.
Yeah.
All that kind of thing, just because of the rise of the litigation culture, which we also tend to blame the US for, have outlawed that kind of behaviour altogether.
Yeah.
So it was quite useful just to kind of read stories about kind of kids being picked up by their throats in the school corridors for misbehaviour by teachers, for example. You know?
And a lot of this was on Friendster, though. Friends Unlimited.
Yeah. Wow. You said Friends Unlimited. Friends Reunited. But,
friends,
yeah. but
well, it may as well be
Unlimited.
It sort of seems like one of these social network sites.
It is pretty unlimited, okay. Never a truer word was spoken in error. That's true.
A Freudian slip, I suppose. I wanted to talk also about the... you have a lot of visual samples from Jason's journal in this, which is a little bit different from you. I was wondering why you... Like, particularly, like, the fragment that opens up the Goose Fair chapter, which kind of reminds us, like, oh, well, this is a kid writing all this in his journal. I was wondering why you felt the need to put in these visual sort of segments. Did you feel that... were you concerned about sort of authenticity of the voices? Was that an issue for you, or...?
That's a good answer. Authenticity. I feel if I'd have however you reproduce an artifact in a book, it will create some kind of message in the reader's head. If you simply change the font size and make the lines closer together, then although that looks as neutral as possible, I felt that it was reminding the reader that this was a book. Mm-hmm. By getting the son of a friend to write these fragments for me, I felt it's my hope that the book feels realer, and we're reminded that this is a kid, a real genuine kid who makes mistakes and kind of spells the odd word wrong, etc., rather than Holden Caulfield. Mm-hmm. I never know if it was the right thing to do or not, and I still don't. And I'm the author of the book, and I can't kind of see things that objectively. But I'm happy with how it looks. It was nice to get. A couple of the other graphics were provided by my mum and dad. So,
oh, really?
Mum wrote the notes that are on the kitchen table in the chapter called The Bridal Way, Path. And dad did the graphic in the same chapter that's a kind of heart cut into a tree that Jason scores into bark with his penknife. That was dad's. And for a while they were joking about, oh, how's our book coming on then, Dave? And it was nice that they could be a part of the process, even in a small way.
Well, you had mentioned earlier that, you know, Jason and you sort of depart in terms of the parents.
Yeah.
Parents in this book are really sort of interesting, although...
Thank you.
You know, well, they're interesting in the sense because you seem to be... There's this little kind of, almost kind of comical sort of understatement because all of their fighting is all about involving money. It seemed to me, anyway. It's like they've got like that whole, you know, dinner scene where they take out the flatware and they go ahead and, like, you know, entertain. But, you know, there's the whole garden situation in this book. And,
yes, it is about money, isn't it?
And it seems to me that all of their sort of problems, it's not just a matter of communication. Even more than that, it's about money. And I didn't know if this was possibly kind of a subtle sort of jab at sort of the money sort of obsessions of Thatcherite sort of England or.
Well, that's clever, Ed. Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, they just seem to be very sort of specifically money centric, and I was wondering if you could talk about that.
oh, how nice it is to find a question that no one's asked me before. That's quite ingenious. Would you mind if I used it in the future?
Oh, sure.
I think really that money is the form that deeper battle about independence takes. Jason's mum kind of she's kind of existentially very unfulfilled, and she's been a housewife all these years. It sounds a bit cliched the way I'm describing it, but in a way I can't help it, because it's at least in the UK, in the middle classes, kind of the effects of feminism was just beginning to were just beginning to kick in. We had a female prime minister. However aggressively she behaved, she was female, and Jason's mum wants her own life, and Jason's dad just can't really handle that so well. Yeah. And kind of what having your own life means, of course, it is sort of being the one who makes the decisions about what happens, I guess, in the family, and how you spend your time, and also how you spend your money, or if you spend the money, or if you earn your own money. A family is an emotional unit, but with its own sort of interpersonal emotional dynamics. But it's also really how it manifests itself in the visible world. It's an economic unit, a financial unit. It's a small state, and throughout the book, Jason's mum kind of stages a secession. That's the right word, isn't it?
Yeah. Almost like a corporate takeover.
Yeah.
Sort of like forming her own sort of LLC, or I don't know.
From within. Yeah. So that's them. Mm. I hadn't noticed that it's very in tune with the times. Sort of the kind of conservative party ethos of the 80s, where everyone sort of has the right and has the means, should have the means to become his or her own millionaire.
Yeah.
And to hell with people who can't keep up. But I like the connection you draw.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I actually wanted to talk about there were several MacGuffins possibly throughout this book that I was wondering about. The first MacGuffin we have are the telephone calls to the father, and we think that the book is going to be about that, but then it really isn't. And then there's also kind of an interesting MacGuffin that I was curious about, and that is Julia, Jason's sister. I felt that I was thinking this was going to be a vital component of the book in terms of, like, you know, because it was such an interesting relationship, but then Julia just disappears, you know?
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk about, like, how these kinds of MacGuffins, so to speak, sort of came about. Was this the natural kind of, course of, like, exploring a 13-month period, or were you deliberately trying to sort of, like, I guess, keep the reader on his toes, you know? Like, by introducing these sort of, like, plot elements that, you know, didn't entirely sort of pay off, or like paid off later, or you know.
Maybe it was a mimetic urge. Life isn't structured like a novel.
Yeah.
And MacGuffins come in and go out all the time.
Sure.
So I guess that was one reason. At the same time, things do go quiet for a long time, but sometimes this kind of background white noise of the short story chapters do resonate later on. So the phone calls in the first January Man were actually the Jason's father's lover, who we then meet right at the end.
Yes.
And she was having some kind of a nervous breakdown at the time, and that's why she was phoning her lover, Jason's father, at home, and because she was sort of on the edge of going in there and radically changing the situation and announcing herself. And
yeah.
unilaterally declaring her intentions, but then pulled back from that. Julia's a sort of, I guess, is a manifestation of how when you're a kid, in fact, one of the worst parts about being a kid, and maybe one of the defining parts about being a kid, you can't control who is in your life. Mm-hmm. No control over it, you know? Mm-hmm. God, that's a tedious thing about being a kid. And if you're 13 listening to this, don't worry, this gets better as well. By the time you're about 18, you can kind of control maybe 50% of the people, and by the time you're 37, like me, maybe 95% of the people I spend time with, I do so because I wish to.
Yeah.
And alleluia. But when you're a kid, you know, your parents have these awful relatives, that, and they come and invade your space all day, and you can not only do nothing about it, you're supposed to interact with them and be nice to them. Mm-hmm. Julia, again, like the slow raising of the register of Jason's language, Jason's relationship with Julia shows his kind of his increasing maturity through the book. They're very close, but in the beginning they don't know they're close.
Yeah.
Jason doesn't know he loves his sister.
Well, that's what made it such a... I mean, I was telling you, you were having your sandwich, I'm close to my sister, and so I kind of... I saw a very sort of like, you know, very dimensional relationship between Jason and his sister.
Oh, well, thank you.
That I really just marveled at, and it was one of those things where it was abandoned. It was like, what? Mm. You know, so it was...
Well, she goes off on a...
Yeah.
She has a boyfriend,
yeah,
and that takes...
Yeah.
Her out of his life, and but they have that nice conversation in December for a couple of pages, it's kind of on the. There's the. Well, there's the Julia principle. Julia is also a song by John Lennon that is over before I want it to be over. it's a fine example of less being more. Of no, don't go back. No, you're too beautiful. Stop. Come back. You can't stop there.
Yeah.
So kind of the Julia principle also dictated that once I'd got the Jason-Julia relationship up and running well, that's precisely the right time to make it vanish for a bit. But
much like the song too. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you couldn't refrain from putting at least one Beatles reference in there.
There's Number 9 Dream as well, which is kind of a post-Beatles record.
Sure,
but yeah.
Sure. Oh yeah, the use of present tense in this. I was wondering, and maybe this goes back. We were kind of getting into sort of like the contractions and the apostrophes, but I don't know if I've really got an answer from you on that.
You haven't, have you? But it's your own fault because you asked four questions.
Well, yes, I know.
Mind isn't muscular enough to keep them all juggling at once. That was the question I dropped. Splat! Yeah. It went.
Yes.
In a mess of yolk and shell. Right. But you got.
We got about two and a half.
Two questions already, Ed.
I don't remember what the fourth one was.
One is the confections, and the other, but
we were specifically talking about like how the how Jason's vernacular was formed,
okay.
How you developed this, where the contractions and the mia morans and the.
It's just how we spoke.
Yeah.
It's just kind of into head research. That's how we spoke, and as Mark Twain discovers in, well, shows in Huckleberry Finn, the vernacular really is good for a character's, as you just said, dimensionality. Mm-hmm. Makes them feel real. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter that it's grammatically incorrect. In fact, it's important that it isn't grammatically correct if that's how they speak.
Yeah.
And it's how I spoke when I was a kid. It's a nice William Trevor line, I think, about like all children, I was bilingual. Just about that's great, isn't it?
Yeah,
there's one way you speak with your friends, and there's one way you speak with your parents, and it is politically dangerous to get those mixed up.
Yeah.
Especially speaking to posh with your friends.
Not just for that, but also ridicule. Like, you know, there's class lines too. I mean, you know, if you're like, if you're either with, you know, with a working class, or if you are, you know, you can't speak certain ways.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you have to sort of adapt your sort of dialect, your vernacular to sort of fit in.
Very true. You know? Yeah.
We have it a lot in this country with, like, an African American, English, which has been called Ebonics, the dialect, and, you know, whatnot. But, you know, it's still this divide, and you know, I think it's not just limited to children.
Sure. On my way here, with my adventures in London, having to get a new passport, I was in the London Underground, and I heard one Arabic-looking kid, maybe of Middle Eastern ethnicity, anyway, talking to his white friend, about 16, and the white kid said, "Dem's lying, man. They not gonna come. Dem's lying. Dem's lying."
Yeah.
You know, it's a teen speak is extraordinary.
We have a lot of hip hop stuff. You have like a lot of like teenage kids in this country who are like literally just trying to be sort of like total, you know, gangsta. And they go ahead and they like speak that way, and they like, you know, they like, yeah, it's really funny. It's like you see a lot of like, you know, particularly in Caucasian suburbia, a lot of like, you know, kids who like blast the music and talk that way and wear the, you know, stuff and the pants down and the cap backwards. And, you know, we have
in order to reject your the culture of your parents, which is a natural urge in kids in order to kind of establish their own identity, you need kind of an other to ape. In Japan, kind of kids ape what they believe are kind of the social behavior, the behavioral patterns of white American kids. White American kids kind of can't behave like white American kids and kind of be rejecting the culture they're from in order to forge their identities kind of in this rejection. So they need something else. That might be black American kids, or sometimes it's even Japan. I've seen some American kids who are kind of really into manga and anime and kind of have an interest in martial arts, and this is what they do. But the people they are aping are equally trying to ape them back. It's a
symbiotic relationship.
Glorious loop, isn't it?
Well, there's actually a little bit of this in Black Swan Green. You have actually, well, with Jason, you make an interesting choice because he sort of wants to be himself. And he doesn't really want to, you know, I mean, he knows he's a poet. He kind of keeps the secretive in all this. And he keeps a lot of his adventures sort of secretive. But, I mean, he's a little bit different from your sort of that type of kind of kid. I was wondering why you stumbled upon that sort of decision to sort of like, you know, I guess, you know, maybe that's one of the reasons why in some of the reviews that he's been compared to Holden Caulfield, because of the whole sort of like integrity, I suppose, of the character.
I suppose so. He's, in a way, even though when I was at school, I was a bit higher up the pecking order than Jason. Not much higher, but a bit higher.
Yeah.
I was always able to be a successful sheep. I suppose kind of Jason's lack of ability to conform turns into a kind of an unwillingness to conform by the end of it. And in a fairly key scene where he destroys a bully's calculator in a metalwork vice. That's kind of despite all the other bad things that happened to him both in the book and after that.
Well, there's that one terrible chapter where he's like has the worst day, he's constantly ridiculed, and there's the whole sort of gym teacher. I mean, that just I read that, like, man, that's, you know, yeah, I remember the days like that. You know,
they're the same all over the world.
Yeah.
But he's going to be okay. He's got this. He kind of identifies a kernel of indestructible will. that I didn't have, that I lacked. And there's a thing about a coward dying 1,000 deaths, isn't there? Well, he died about 250, but after this book, you get the feeling that he's going to stop. That he'll he's got something indestructible inside him, and that will stand him in very good stead. And I wished I had it, but I didn't. And hey, here we are.
Why choose upon the age of 12, 13 to sort of like, you know, find this more kind of personal voice? And also, a related kind of question, I'll throw just two at you.
I can handle two.
Yeah, the Murakami influence. I kind of saw Black Swan Green as an effort on your part to sort of shake off the Murakami yoke. That's how I put it anyway. Mm. I was wondering if you can maybe tie these two in together.
I'll have a go.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I can, but I'll have a go. They're both good questions. Answer to your first question, I chose the 13th year because you are no longer a boy, but you're not a teenager.
Yeah.
Really. So the survival strategies that worked when you were a kid no longer, you know, people don't get toys anymore. Things that made you popular a year ago no longer work. Yet, what are the rules? You don't know what they are. Mm-hmm. It's all too new. It's an amazing, defining, informative window of time that really influences who we become as adults, I think. The Murakami yoke, I kind of can't say I consciously strove to write a book totally unlike anything that the great Murakami would write. It's just more true to say that I'm getting older and I'm finding my own voice and bifurcating from influences that I wedded myself to earlier in my brilliant career. No, earlier in my tawdry career.
So you view like the first three books as tawdry?
I view them as the books of a younger man, one who knew less about writing, and I hope this will always be true. I hope in 3 books' time, I will look back at Black Swan Green and wince. Mm-hmm. It's not that I'm not proud of them. It's just that they're the best books that the 29-year-old, that the 32-year-old, and the 34-year-old, respectively, could have produced. Mm-hmm. But they teach me. They teach me more things about writing. And the point is to incorporate these lessons into your future books. Into the book in hand.
And yet there are references, though, from those 3 books. If this is a first novel, I don't know about that, because you have, the offspring of Frobisher returns in this book, Black Swan Green.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if you read the Ed Park Village Voice review yet, but I mean, I'll have to send it to you or something, but he really sort of totally dissected Black Swan Green, but put it with very specific sort of contextual sort of like references to your other work. And he pointed out actually that there's actually quite a lot that that you've sort of thrown from your other books into this. And I was wondering, I guess it seems the part of you can't quite sort of like, you know, say no to sort of like, you know, an eccentric like Kramalink, you know, or anything like that.
Well, she is the answer to the question, how do I bring in a bit of metaphysics into the book? How can I talk about truth and beauty in a way that maybe not even Holden Caulfield could, let alone Jason? And it's not so much I can't let go, it's just I succumb to the temptation, which isn't quite the same thing, of advertising vacant positions to previous characters, just to see if they would fit, if they could fit, if they should fit. And if they do, I sometimes give them a job. I do this for fun and also for the practical reason they bestow the realness that they have accrued from their previous incarnation on to the new book. They make it feel realer if you've read it, and if you've read the previous incarnation and remember it, of course. It has to work if you haven't. I mean, it has to work. It has to be kind of. It has to meet all the criteria of fiction. I don't want them to be dependent prequels or sequels, but if you've read previous things and you like them and you spot them here, then you feel you have a shared history with that character, and that makes the present thing again. It aids suspension of disbelief. Mm-hmm. Did you spot Neil Broz, by the way?
Which one?
Neil Hughes,
the Falkland, the guy who died in the Falklands.
That's Nick Yu. Tom Yu.
Tom, okay.
Neil Broz, he's the wheeler-dee-living bully who gets his calculator crushed.
Oh, yeah.
He was also the stockbroker in the Hong Kong section of my first novel,
Ghostwritten.
That's him. So that's his last day. kind of in my first novel.
And that's funny. It's been a couple of years since I've read Ghostwritten.
It's been 6 years since I read it myself, so I'm not blaming you. And I rather like that most people don't spot him, but that's him.
Okay. Gotcha. I think actually Ed Park may have referenced him. Okay. I don't know if he got that one though. But that one's pretty obscure.
Yeah. It is.
Well. Why did you name the headmaster Nixon? Aside from the obvious reasons.
Almost all of the names are taken from Ordnance Survey Map 150, which is the kind of the originally a government programmed map of the UK. Mm-hmm. Ordnance Survey, it's called. And 150 is the area of Worcestershire and a bit of Gloucestershire and a bit of Herefordshire. Around where the book is set. So almost all of the kids, people's names in Black Swan Green are names that I found off on that map.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Nixon's one of the exceptions.
I would think so.
Names are peculiar things. You kind of need to get them right.
No, but I was wondering if Richard Milhouse was, a consideration. And it seems natural for a headmaster to,
I think this headmaster has more integrity than President Nixon. It's a useful coincidence that they have the same name.
Yeah.
But other than that, I chose it because it's a near palindrome, and they stick on the eyeball well, and it's good to have names that stick on the eyeball, especially for people who are key yet who don't appear very often.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, totally.
Just going to see if I can order some tea here.
Okay.
As he loves his leg of beef.